This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Sunday, police in Maryland shot and killed a teenager after he charged them with a pair of scissors. His mother had warned police in advance that he may not have taken his medication for psychotic episodes. And while that incident is extreme, it illustrates both the difficulty and the importance of getting the best mental health care for kids. May is Mental Health Month. Last week we talked about mental health care for adults. Today we'll talk about how to get the best mental health care for children. Of course, mental illness does not usually involve violence, but it often wreaks havoc on children's lives and on the lives of their families. In New York City today, the Department of Health is offering free depression screening for kids, but often knowing when and where to get help can be tricky. Today we'll talk with a practicing clinical psychologist and a practicing child psychiatrist about the steps to take and the questions to ask along the way. Join the conversation. If you have questions about the signs or symptoms of mental illness in children, about what types of treatment are available, or what degree of angst is normal in the growing up years, give us a phone call, but we have to include a disclaimer. We cannot diagnose individual problems or prescribe treatments over the radio. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, who owns baseball's hallowed numbers? We'll talk with Alan Schwartz about the feud between fantasy and Major League Baseball. But first, children and mental health. Our first guest struggled with his son's mental illness. Writer Pete Early is the author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. He joins us here in Studio 3A. And thanks very much for coming in to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Looking back over your son's childhood, when did you first see signs that he had mental problems?
Well, he was in college, and he developed a mania. We took him to a psychiatrist. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He was in his early 20s. He was prescribed a medicine that worked, and even though he was hospitalized twice, he was able to go back to school. Then he developed another serious attack. I drove to New York to get him from Virginia, and during that four-hour ride home, I can't tell you how painful it was. He would laugh for no reason, then sob, and then he said to me, "Dad, how would you feel if someone you loved killed themselves?" So then I did what any parent would do. I rushed him to an emergency room. After waiting 4 hours, a doctor came in, and I'll never forget, he came in with his hands up as if he was surrendering, and he said, "I'm sorry, but I can't treat your son." I said, "You haven't even examined him. He's been hospitalized twice. He has a history of having a mental disorder." He said, "I'm sorry, Virginia law is very specific. You have to be in imminent danger, which means you're about to hurt yourself or someone else. Take him home, and if he hurts you or someone else, you can bring him back." At that point, my son thought pills were poison, so he had refused any kind of treatment.
And your son was over the age of 18, so this was not something that you could impose on him.
That's exactly right. I took him home, and then during the next 48 hours, I watched him decompensate. At one point, he had tin foil wrapped around his head, and he thought the CIA was trying to read his thoughts. He slipped out of my house and broke into a neighbor's house to take a bubble bath. The police came, hauled him out, and I thought, well, at least now I'll get him help. I went to a community treatment center, and the policeman said, "Unless you go in and tell him that he's about to hurt you or someone else, or he's threatened you, he will not get any help. We'll take him to jail." So I was so frustrated, I went in and I lied. I said, "My son threatened to kill me." Then he went to a hospital, and I thought, finally, he'll get help. And I got there, and the nurse said, "No, unless he's in imminent danger, we'll release him in 48 hours. So he was in the hospital, and then I got a call from the police saying he'd been charged for two felonies. So I was very frustrated. Here on one point, I tried to get him help, and the law had stopped me. Now the law was going to punish him for his sickness.
Hmm. How's your son doing?
Well, unfortunately, mental illness is a lifetime disease. It can be treated but not cured. He was on probation for 2 years, and he took his medicine every day. 6 months ago, he decided not to take it, and so we're back in the same position, trying to keep him from doing anything to hurt himself or someone else or to get arrested again.
And again, this problem is not going to go away either. By state and federal laws, he's an adult. He can make his own decisions.
That's right, and I understand why. I researched this, and it goes back to when we had the old asylums. There were horrible places where people were committed for life and got no treatment. And I understand we put laws in effect to keep people from just being arrested because they're mentally ill and then given a forced lobotomy. But times have changed, and we know so much more now. And also, you do no one any good when you take someone who's psychotic and you know it that they know you know they are, and you could treat them. 80% can be treated, and you turn them out on the street to hurt someone else.
Let me ask you a question that I think occurs to a lot of parents of children with mental disorders, and that's about the guilt that you feel. I mean, obviously, you're rushing to try to get help for your child, but at the same time, is this my fault? Is this something I did? This is difficult to cope with.
Well, I didn't have too much of that guilt because I read a lot about mental illness, and I realized that it's a brain disorder. It's caused by chemicals in the brain. We know that. We don't know what causes it, but we know that it's a chemical imbalance, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia that affects how the nerves send and transmit messages. What I felt more guilty about was being unable to help a child. It's so painful. Can you imagine taking someone in and has a compound fracture, your little child, and being told come back when he's closer to death? That's what was so frustrating. Plus, the big fear for someone who has a mentally ill child is that they're going to hurt somebody. Last week, Fairfax County, an 18-year-old who was psychotic, who was untreated, opened up shooting at a police station. He killed a police officer, a detective, who happened to be a friend of mine and who had happened to really help my son. So, you know, you have two tragedies, the person who was murdered and then the 18-year-old who was shot by the police. And both of those could have been prevented.
Which raises some questions for our next guest, who is Raymond Kroll, a practicing clinical psychologist, vice president of the National Mental Health Association. Now, he was with us last week, as you'll remember, when our focus was on adults, and he's with us again here in Studio 3, and it's nice to have you back on the program today.
Pleasure to be back with you.
And the incidents of both Pete Early's son and this terrible situation last week in Virginia, kids over the age of 18, but that transition, as children get older, is there something their parents can do?
Well, it is probably one of the most difficult processes or points in the life of a child or a young adult who has a mental illness, and it is we move from a system where parents make all the decisions for children, what medications, what hospitals, what schools, when they go in and out, to a point where after 18, the child is responsible for making all those decisions. What we know about brain development is that children aren't necessarily, even at 18, capable of making good, responsible choices necessarily. And when you add a mental health problem on top of that, it makes it a very complicated and very painful process. Mm-hmm. And our laws are geared towards ensuring the rights of the individual. And it's sad to say that unless someone is considered dangerous to themselves or to another, most of the hospitalization or alternatives are very limited.
Pete, as you've looked into it, is there a change in the law that you can see that would cover the question of people's rights without getting them getting on the other side of that problem?
Well, several states have tried to change the imminent danger, change the language in it. Maryland, for instance, tried to lessen it. But most of the attention has been focused on after a person is arrested or after they have been have a history of mental problems and get into trouble. And that's assisted outpatient treatment, also known as forced medication. The classic laws in New York, Kendra's Law, where a young woman was pushed in front of a subway train by a psychotic individual who had a long history of mental illness. In those cases, someone who's been off their medication for a long time, who's has a history of danger or cannot take care of themselves, can be forced by a judge to show up and take their medication or they can be arrested. What bothers me about that kind of thing is you have to get into the criminal justice system to get help. And that's just simply unfair. My son faces two stigmas now, mental illness and also that he's a criminal. And that's just wrong in my book.
Mm-hmm. And this is not simply a problem for kids over 18, is it, Dr. Kroll?
No, not at all. All too often we have a number of children who are adolescents who get themselves into trouble. And because they either run into, have no contact with the mental health system or no one refers them or detects the problem, they are not actually discovered to have a mental health problem until they land in the juvenile justice system. We've ended up developing mental health courts for juveniles and mental health courts for adults to try to deal with some of those issues, but it is late in the system, and it's mm-hmm. entering, quite honestly, through the wrong door.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, in the case of Pete Early's son, this manifested itself after he turned 18, but are there signs that parents can look for as their children are, you know, to look out for the danger signs, if you will?
Well, sometimes. I mean, sometimes you'll see a change gradually over time in a child. When parents look back, sometimes they can see the change, but just weren't aware of what they were looking at. Other times, it may come full blown out of later on in adulthood, or once a child ages out or becomes 18 or 19 or 20. But you can see, typically when you're thinking about development, we're talking about a normal pattern, and most parents will recognize a typical child's usual behavior patterns and their typical ups and downs, and it's deviation or change from those typical patterns that usually signal that there's something amiss.
We want to get listeners involved in the conversation as well. Join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org, and we'll begin with Brian. Brian calling from San Francisco.
Yeah, hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
I just want to bring up the point with my own situation. My daughter at the time was 14 and had an extremely serious suicide attempt. And your guest just brought up the fact that some of these signs aren't necessarily real obvious. You think your daughter, your child is just growing up, normally going through the emotional issues that 14-year-olds have, and it turned out that my daughter had been hoarding a number of different medications for what was probably years, and attempted to take them all at one time.
Dr. Kroll, with all sympathy to Brian, he's not alone. That's not unusual.
He's absolutely not alone. There is, unfortunately, way too many children who attempt to take their lives and too many who succeed in taking their lives each year in this country. And it is not always obvious to parents. Sometimes it's obvious to peers or friends. And certainly we try to do things to encourage peers and friends to step forward and try to get them some adult help. But sometimes it's hard to see.
Brian, how's she doing?
Yeah, I just want to be clear. It was an attempt.
Yes.
Successful suicide. Well, she's going to college next year, and she's had a rough time of it. It's a lot of times we got her into some help. She was very resistant to that, but was basically locked up almost for almost 3 weeks before we could get her out of the she was declared what we call in California 5150, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to get. That was the only way we could get her help, and it was basically forced upon her.
Brian, thanks very much. We wish you and her the best of luck. And Pete Early, thank you for coming in today. We know you had other things to do and appreciate you running in to join us. Pete Early, the author of Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. He joined us here in Studio 3A. More after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, we talked about finding quality health care for adults. Today, mental health care for children younger than 18. What can be done to help them? Our guest is Raymond Kroll, a practicing clinical psychologist, vice president of the National Mental Health Association. If you have questions about mental health care for kids, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And Raymond Kroll, Pete Early's son in college, our first caller, his daughter showed signs at 14. How young can children be when they display symptoms of mental problems?
We don't acknowledge necessarily that there's a bottom age in that. As children as young as 2 or 3 years old may be showing some signs of an emotional, or I should say a mental health problem. That may be something as simple as autism, or maybe a childhood schizophrenia, or maybe even depression as young as 4 or 5 years of age. So.
As young as 4 or 5?
Yes.
Can doctors treat it? Can they help the kids?
Yes, absolutely. The good news about this is that there are a variety of treatments that are available. And, of course, medication is one of the things that's probably most common that people are most familiar with. But there are a variety of psychotherapies, a variety of things that we can do with parents and children at very young ages that help children to develop emotionally into emotionally more healthy adults and to get the balance back in their lives.
Mm. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Mark. Mark with us from Portland.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm thinking back way back into the 60s when it was not so well known and this was not as easily understood and children were just looked at as hyperactive and growing up with a brother who was exhibiting these symptoms that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher's misunderstanding it back then even being rather harsh with students, and he was put out in the hall, and left alone to cry, and I discovered this at an early age, seeing this in the hall, but later watching and growing up with all this and seeing the medical authorities and understanding it better in the late 60s and the early 70s a little bit, but still the problems it causes within the home are really, I think the families suffer more than the public realizes, and as the guest was reflecting on with his son, I remember similar situations with my own brother. But what disturbs me today is that as much as the parents, I think, are trying to protect their own children out of their own caring for their loved ones, even against the available help that is there today with the authorities, I noticed a kind of a strange dichotomy taking place in the last 20 or 30 years, and that this protection of the mentally insane is actually protecting. I want to think of a phrase: we're protecting ourselves from ourselves. My father asking for help from the authorities, but in some instances, the authorities would not even allow information when he would call to check on her brother or his whereabouts or how he's being placed in a group home.
For privacy protection.
For privacy protection, but it became so difficult that although I think the authorities were doing a better job in recent years where President Reagan had them all, the patients removed from facilities and back into public, which is probably good, they're going to have to eventually reform and get along with everyone. But I saw this slowly moving to where there was a less and less contact with the real family because they were trying to protect the patient, of course. So I'm guessing what's happened is, for their own good, it's probably better that some parents, not knowing how to handle this, the authorities better versed in it, has left the parents feeling kind of helpless in some instances.
Raymond Kroll?
Sure. I think historically we've gone from, as Peter early mentioned, from a time when it was easy to treat people as criminals because they had a major mental illness, to a point where we have made sure or taken extra steps to make sure that a person's privacy and rights are protected. And that means that as an adult, that their rights are protected, even sometimes against from people who would actually help them or be interested in helping them. I think we're moving back in the direction of trying more, especially with younger children and adolescents, to engaging the family in the process of treatment, because we recognize that at least one of the protective factors in working with young children and young adults is caring relationships, and that some of that oftentimes begins in the home and in the family.
Mark, thanks very much. My 8-year-old son, writes Karen in Cleveland, said he wanted to kill himself. I don't think he means it in a serious way, but how do I respond without minimizing something so important but without overreacting? I want him to understand it is a serious thing to say, but not to hide it if he does really feel that way. How does your guest suggest responding to a threat of suicide when a parent does not think their child is in immediate serious danger? Should schools be told?
I think that the first order of business in this case is to sit and talk with the child and try to get a clear sense about what they understand or don't understand about what suicide is or what it means, and then to get a clear sense of what's going on with the child and why they might want to hurt themselves. There are some other things about assessing sort of just briefly the level of seriousness of this. Have you thought about how you'd do that? What might you do?
Mm-hmm.
I would not necessarily take the step immediately of informing the school around this. I might instead recommend that they find talk to their pediatrician, get a referral to a psychologist or social worker or a psychiatrist who might be able to do a level of assessment. It's important to take it seriously.
To talk more about treatment options for children with mental illness, we turn now to Dr. David Fassler, a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist, also a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont. He's with us by phone from New York City today, and it's nice to have you on the program today, Dr. Fassler.
Happy to be here, Neil.
What tools do you use to diagnose mental illness in a child?
Well, you know, it's a good question, because I think one of the most important things and one of the most important messages for parents who are listening is the importance of getting a really good evaluation. The main tool is to do a comprehensive evaluation, which will include understanding the child's early development, the family history, how they're doing in school. You need to look at their medical history. There are certainly other medical conditions and medications that can create signs and symptoms that look like mental illness. And you need to spend time with the child and with the family. And this isn't an evaluation that can be done in a quick 5 or 10 minute office visit. You really need to look at all of these areas and then figure out what's going on. It's critical to get, and you've heard this in some of the comments already, it's critical to get an accurate diagnosis before you begin to think about the various treatment options.
And what are the most common mental illnesses in children? I mean, obviously hearing references to attention deficit disorder.
Well, certainly we we see problems with attention deficit. We also see a significant amount of depression. We see problems with conduct disorder. We see developmental delays where kids are developing either more slowly or differently than they should. We see kids with conduct disorder problems who are getting into trouble a lot and fighting a lot in school. And certainly, as kids get older, we see more and more problems with substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of treatment options? Obviously, we were talking with Raymond Kroll earlier, including medication, talk therapy.
Sure. You know, I think almost all kids with psychiatric problems benefit from individual treatment. One issue is by the time they get to see us or another mental health professional, they've often had these problems for months. With depression, it's 6 to 9 months that the symptoms may have existed. So there are often lots of secondary emotional issues. There are self-esteem issues. They may feel this is their fault or they've done something wrong. So I think individual therapy, counseling can be extremely helpful for the majority of kids with mental illnesses. I think working with the family, as you've already talked about, mm-hmm. can be extremely important. And I think medication can be very helpful. And I've even seen medication save lives. But I think medication by itself is rarely the appropriate intervention for these kinds of serious psychiatric disorders. It should only be used really as a component of a comprehensive treatment plan.
As you know, there's plenty of controversy over prescribing adult medications for children. In most cases, the drugs haven't been tested on children and are prescribed off-label. What do we know about the costs and benefits?
About the risks and benefits? Well, I think it's an area where physicians and parents need to learn as much as they can. They need to get lots of information, and they need to discuss the full range of treatment options and then make the decision that's right for that particular child. Mm-hmm. Medication, again, can be extremely helpful and important, and it can and does save lives, but there are other kinds of treatments as well. And the critical thing is to get a good evaluation, find a clinician who you like and trust. And if you're not clicking with a clinician or it just doesn't feel right or you're not getting the answers that you need, get a second opinion. I think that's one of the most important things, is to get to someone that that you and your child feel comfortable with and can work with.
All right. Let's get some more callers on the line. We'll turn to Lisa. Lisa with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm the mother of a wonderful 7-year-old who about 6 months ago said that she was hearing voices. She said that these voices just say her name, but my husband and I were concerned enough that we took her to her doctor, who really just kind of poo-pooed it, like it was really, oh, you know, 7-year-olds, and she probably just has a creative imagination and that sort of thing. But I did have concerns because my husband's mother was bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me, so just for our peace of mind, more or less, she did refer us to a counselor who saw our daughter, you know, maybe 3 times and really just kind of had the same reaction, just kind of like, well, it was probably just an adjustment issue, or it was probably, you know, just no big deal. But just kind of encouraged us to keep the lines of communication open, to have our, you know, daughter kind of express to us when she heard the voices and that sort of thing. And, you know, like I said, this was about 6 months ago, and she still, like, will occasionally mention that she hears the voices, and they don't say anything other than her name.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was just, you know, I don't really feel like I got a very good evaluation, and I'm kind of concerned about, like, where do I go from here, or, you know, am I overreacting, or, you know, what would be a good next step?
Raymond Kroll, would this seem to call for a second opinion, do you think?
I think absolutely. I think it's important for you to feel comfortable that the evaluation you've gotten does answer the question. And I think the 3 sessions is fine, but I think that probably a more comprehensive evaluation might be in order in this case.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but I'm trying to figure out what that noise was.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, so, I mean, she went to just a counselor. Would you suggest that I take her to a psychiatrist or a psychologist or...
I would suggest either a psychiatrist or a psychologist who has some skills in diagnosing and diagnostics and evaluation mm-hmm. of children that age. And I would certainly suggest that you interview them and talk with them about their process for diagnosis and interviewing before you make a decision to see one.
And Lisa, we wish you and your daughter the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Dr. Fassler, let me ask you an associated question, and that is there is a shortage of children's psychiatrists nationwide.
Absolutely true. We have less than half the number of child and adolescent psychiatrists that we need. I would say if anyone is listening who is interested in becoming a child and adolescent psychiatrist, please consider it seriously. It is a wonderful field. The good news is that we actually can help most of the kids who suffer from these kinds of illnesses. We can't cure every kid, but we can significantly reduce the extent to which the problems interfere with their lives. Let me also mention that there is a bill in Congress called the Child Mental Health Workforce Bill, both in the House and the Senate, that would help us with additional funding for training of all kinds of child mental health professionals. So we are actively working to recruit more people into child and adolescent psychiatry. The other thing we're doing is we're working more collaboratively with our colleagues in pediatrics and primary care. Just now in Vermont, where I'm working, we're starting a program where we have six child and adolescent psychiatrists who will be spending time side by side with pediatricians in their offices, both to see kids and to teach the pediatricians what it is that we do, how we do evaluations, how we make decisions about treatment.
We're talking about getting the best mental health care for children today. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dr. Fassler, let me ask you another question, and that is, given the critical shortage of child psychiatrists, any other ideas where people may turn to help?
Well, I think the key issue is getting a good evaluation. Not all treatment needs to be done by a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and there are other very well-trained and qualified mental health professionals for particular kinds of problems. But as in the previous call, if there's a question, and I thought Dr. Krell's answer was perfect, if there's a parent who still has a question in their mind and they're not sure if there's something going on, do whatever you have to do to push to the next level, to get the best possible evaluation by the person with the most training and expertise. Talk to your pediatrician, to your family doctor, to the school guidance counselor, to the principal. Call the local medical school. They will always have a department of psychiatry, and they will usually have a department of child and adolescent psychiatry. Talk to a community mental health center. Call the local medical society. But do whatever you have to do to get to the right person to at least help you figure out what's going on. We tend to wait too long if kids have emotional or behavioral problems. If a child has a headache that's not going away for 2 weeks, we don't think twice about figuring out how to get them to the right doctor who can help evaluate it. Or if a child comes home from summer camp and they're limping, we deal with it right away. But these kinds of psychiatric issues tend to wait much longer, and we have a lot of kids who really aren't getting the evaluations and aren't getting the appropriate treatment that they need and deserve.
Raymond Kroll?
Yeah, one of the things I would add to that, just thinking about the treatment issues, is that individual therapy, medication are great treatment options and are absolutely at the heart of what we think needs to happen for children who have mental health problems. Children also live in context. They live in schools, they live in communities, and they sometimes cross systems into the juvenile justice system, et cetera. It's important increasingly that we find ways to work collaboratively with those systems, that families know that there are mental health professionals who are involved, that the systems know there are mental health professionals who are involved, and that those professionals get engaged with those systems to try to help build a network or support around a child so that their environment is more therapeutic for them.
Dr. Fassler, I have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I did want to ask about how parents can tell the difference between the normal crises of adolescence, and those can be pretty profound in and of themselves, and something that's that they should be really worried about.
Right. I think there are a couple of key issues to look for. One is sort of the pervasiveness of the signs or symptoms. So are they lasting across more than one setting? So it's a problem at home and a problem in school, or it's a problem with friends and in school. Second is the duration. So are these behaviors or symptoms lasting at least a couple of weeks? So it's not just like a child had a bad weekend or a bad couple of days. Third is, do they represent a change for a particular child? And the fourth and the most important is, are they interfering with the child's ability to function, either in home, at school, or with their friends? So if you have a child that's having signs or symptoms or behaviors in more than one setting, they're not going away, it seems different, and it's getting in the way of their ability to function, get it checked out. I don't think parents should have to make that decision on their own. I am reflecting on your caller earlier who had a 7-year-old, I think, who mm-hmm. was talking about suicide or that they might want to die. I don't think a parent should be put in the position of having to decide, is my child serious about this? There are people who are really trained to do that kind of evaluation, and you need to push and make sure that you get to the right person.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your questions about how to get the best mental health care for children. We're also going to be talking about a lawsuit that's underway. Who owns Barry Bonds' batting average? There's a lawsuit looking to find out, and it's Tuesday. We'll read from your emails. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few minutes, who owns the batting averages and all those other baseball statistics and your letters on spying, on congressional pork, and on funny politicians. But first, we're continuing our conversations on how to find the best mental health care for children. Our guests are Raymond Kroll, a practicing clinical psychologist and vice president of the National Mental Health Association, and Dr. David Fassler, a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist and a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Lorraine. Lorraine calling from Ferndale in Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
I am the adoptive mother of an 8-year-old who we recently got a diagnosis of bipolar disorder for. And I'm listening to these people talking about, you know, getting proper medical care, getting proper diagnoses. And one of the things that kept coming into my mind was, you know, getting a second opinion, but there are so many doctors out there who are quick to make a diagnosis, and you may trust them and go along with it. It took 2 years after getting an initial diagnosis of bipolar, we found a psychiatrist that we trusted,
mm-hmm.
and we wrote it out with some other diagnoses that altogether could have come up with bipolar. We finally had his symptoms escalate to hearing voices and many other things, and he now has this diagnosis of bipolar. He's on medication and doing really well. But after all of these years of battling this, because he has had many mental health problems, including the fact that he was exposed to alcohol and drugs in utero, we now have to fight with our family and with the school system, because the school psychologist actually laughed when she was told that he had a diagnosis of bipolar, as if she knew better and thought that, you know, this could just be blown off. And family members who say, you know, kids this young do not get mentally ill. You know, what did they do with him 25 years ago, 30 years ago? They didn't give them medication and send them to therapy. This is ridiculous. He's just being a brat.
Hmm.
He's just spoiled.
Yeah, Raymond Kroll, denial not only in the people who have mental problems.
Well, 25, we know certainly a lot more about how to diagnose and how to assess and how to treat the childhood mental illnesses than we did 25 years ago. Families have to be the best and toughest advocate for their children. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of misinformation and a lack of awareness and education about the extent of childhood mental illness, and families have to combat that both in schools and sometimes, unfortunately, even in their own families.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Fassler, it's, you know, is it unusual for even a child psychiatrist or a school psychiatrist to say, you know, ridiculous, the kids this young don't have these kind of problems?
Well, we're still learning more and more about conditions like bipolar disorder in younger kids. Certainly when I was in medical school, we were actually taught that kids didn't get depressed, and they certainly didn't get bipolar
right.
disorder. Now we're learning more and more about depression and about bipolar disorder, although I can understand why it took a couple of years to get an accurate diagnosis. People are still figuring out in the field exactly what...
We were actually grateful
mm-hmm.
that the psychiatrist that we had been seeing over this 2-year period, the initial diagnosis came from an MSW,
mm-hmm.
and we went looking for a second opinion and one we could trust more than we trusted her. And he was very slow to finally give us this diagnosis.
And I think
because he was cautious.
Right, and I think people should be. This is a difficult diagnosis. There are a number of different psychiatric disorders that can present with signs and symptoms that look like bipolar disorder in young kids, but I'm glad that you got an accurate diagnosis, that your son is getting treatment, and that he's doing well. The one resource I wanted to add in terms of dealing with your family is really to learn as much as you can about the disorder, read as much as you can. There are a number of good books out there. I was also going to give you the website of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, which is...
I've been there.
I've been there,
and I do a lot of readings
on that material, and
pass out a lot of printouts, like from the child... Was it Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation?
Great.
Things like that.
Raymond Crowell, you had something to add?
Yeah, just that it's important that the diagnosis needs to be methodical and point. I think Dr. Fassler makes a good point about that, is that it needs to be one that is done over time and not very quickly and not rushed to judgment. We're dealing with developmental issues as well as what's going the current picture, and so there has to be, diagnoses have to be done in light of that developmental process as well.
Okay. Lorraine, I'm glad to hear your son is doing better.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Dr. Fassler, thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
David Fassler, a practicing child and adolescent psychiatrist and a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont, was kind enough to join us today on the phone from New York City. He's the co-author of Help Me, I'm Sad, Recognizing, Treating, and Preventing Childhood and Adolescent Depression. We'd also like to thank Raymond Crowell for being with us here in the studio these past couple of weeks, talking about where to find the best mental health care for both adults last week and children this week. Thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Raymond Crowell, a clinical psychologist and vice president of the National Mental Health Association. And when we come back, who owns baseball statistics?